Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Michael Kilpatrick. He is the co-founder of Growing Farmers, and he is a host, an inventor, an online entrepreneur, and he's doing so much to help farmers make their businesses successful. And I'll tell you more about him in a little bit when he actually comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things in and around the news, talk to you a little bit about my Zoom classes, and of course, share with you my weekly recipe. So my Zoom classes are continuing, and they are growing and gaining momentum. And it's really just so much fun to bring my passion for vegan cooking out into the world and share it with those that are quarantining at home and having time to explore healthy cooking and experimenting with some new foods. And so it's really a pleasure to be sharing these recipes with you out there. So if you have not joined yet, just know that it is every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And next week, we're actually going to be making appetizers. Up until this point, I've been doing main course meals. But I've had some requests from people, you know, as we start opening up and entertaining again. People have been asking me for some of my favorite appetizers, and one of them is using beet greens and radish greens, the parts of beets and radishes that so often people just throw out. I have made a great pate out of, and it's just delicious, and so I'll share that with you, along with hummus. I know everyone just buys hummus, but the hummus you buy is nothing like what you can whip up in 5 minutes, so I'm going to share that with you. And then also some stuffed mushrooms. Stuffed mushrooms are, you know, people's favorites, but so often they're loaded with butter and cheese, and I will share with you a delicious vegan recipe where you don't need to put any of that dairy in it. So, I hope to see more of you joining in my Zoom cooking classes. But I wanted to also talk about what's going on in the world. Of course, we still are dealing with the COVID-19, and that is, you know, hitting everyone's news feed constantly as states start slowly opening up. And in some states, the numbers are spiking again, or spiking for the first time. And how we can do it and open up and, you know, get to this new normal that we need to get to, because we can't stay in isolation forever. We know that, but how do we really start getting together again in a safe manner and not spread the disease? So, you know, part of that is just being careful, you know, making sure that you keep your distance. Hugging is okay again if you just turn your head the other way so you're not breathing on people. And I think it's really important that we start carefully getting together again. You know, wash your hands. Just keep washing your hands, and let's all do the best we can. But also in the news, in our news feed, is the acknowledgement that our country is plagued with systemic racism that goes back before slavery, and what we need to do really to dismantle it. And the first part, I think, is to really acknowledge that it exists. Denial is what is going to keep everything the same, and we need to acknowledge it so that we can make change. And in my newsletter, I shared a website that Slow Food USA actually shared. They put out a great reading list so that people can educate them about what it is to be a racist and how to be an anti-racist. And I'm actually just ordered the book How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. And my Slow Food chapter, we're going to read this book as kind of a book club and really discuss it. My Slow Food chapter is predominantly white. On our board, we have nobody of color. We have tried to make ourselves open to and looking to become more diversified, but in our demographics and where we live, it's just not happening. And so we need to figure out better ways of blending and coming together with our neighbors in communities of color and really expanding. And so Slow Food USA is really looking at that. My chapter, Slow Food North Shore, is looking at it. And I invite everybody to look at it. You know, I've worked for the River Fund New York Food Pantry for many years. Many of you have volunteered with me cooking for, you know, 1,000 people for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I know that the roots of hunger stems from poverty. And in order to break that cycle, we have to break the cycle of poverty. And the way we do that is by dismantling this systemic racism. Because the way it is right now, not only do we have over 38 million people living in poverty, 11 million of those children, but the poverty is so ingrained, starting with poor education, which leads to poor jobs, poor housing, poor nutrition, and the racism that plays into that on all levels is so prevalent. I remember taking a course when I was in college, and it was one of the most important courses I've ever taken on diversity. And, you know, as a school teacher, to get your education degree, you actually had to take a class on diversity. But it was just amazing to watch these hidden cameras show how blatant it was. You know, you'd go into a real, you know, these people would go into a real estate office, a black couple looking for an apartment, and they'd say there's nothing available. And then 10 minutes later, a white couple goes in and they show them all these apartments. You know, you go to get a car loan, and, you know, the car loan is at a certain rate for the black couple, and then a white couple goes in and they get a car rate much lower. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Supermarkets in neighborhoods of color very often are more expensive. Even if they're a no-name supermarket, they can be more expensive than a chain supermarket because they build in, or they say they build in money for shoplifters. I mean, it's just, you know, on every level, this course just pointed out how racism plays into things. And I think it is finally really coming to a tipping point, and I really welcome people to you know, join these marches, you know, peaceful marches. You can go to websites like Justice for George NYC here in New York to find out where there's rallies and protests in New York and in the boroughs. You can go to the website Black Lives Matters, the Long Island Progressive Coalition has things going on. I know this Sunday, June 14th, in Mineola, in front of the courthouse on Old Country Road from 3 to 5, there's a peaceful protest planned for families, and I hope to be there, so I hope to see some of you there. So anyway, it's just really important that we all get behind this and work together as one community with our brothers and sisters of all colors, race, sexual orientation, you name it. We need to be unified, to come together and push for equality for all and for the American dream for all, because right now it certainly is not. You know, systemic racism also plays out in pollution and in nutrition. And right now on my website, I put a link, and I'm asking everybody to please sign their name to this. Right now, the Trump administration is trying to give a green light to polluters. They have directed the Environmental Protection Agency to stop enforcing the environmental regulations that are a law right now and giving a green light to corporate polluters and using the crisis that we're in right now as an excuse. But we have seen that the pandemic really affects people of color more than any other grouping, and that's because so often they're living near toxic waste sites, fracking sites, near areas where they're spraying with pesticides and herbicides, and also poor nutrition. because cheap food, fast food, is cheap. And we need to change that too. So again, systemic racism plays into all of these things. But right now we need to come together and raise our voices and not let the Environmental Protection Agency deregulate and roll back regulating the protections that are in place. So please look at my website and sign that. Now I'd like to share with you my recipe so that my guests can then come on. This week on my Zoom class, we made grilled portobello mushrooms that were stuffed with creamed spinach, and of course that's a vegan creamed spinach, with roasted asparagus and red peppers. And I did it indoors in an inside grill, but this can also, you know, parts of this can also be made outside if you're entertaining outside on the grill. And I served it with an herbed brown rice and a baby arugula salad with also microgreens that I had from my garden. And I made a pear vinaigrette with it, and I garnished it with fresh beets and strawberries. And it's a great summer salad. And, of course, strawberries are in season right now, too. So it's always fun to come up with recipes, making use of what's in season. And one of the reasons I shared this recipe is because I had spinach, asparagus, all growing in my garden, as well as the microgreens. Okay, so for the grilled portobello mushrooms with creamed spinach, roasted asparagus, and red peppers, you want to start by marinating the portobello mushrooms. So I got 8 large mushrooms, and I made a marinade with 1/2 cup of olive oil, 1/4 cup of balsamic vinegar, 1 tablespoon of tamari, and 1 teaspoon of minced garlic. And I just made that marinade up, and I put it into a plastic bag with all of my mushrooms. If you don't have a really large Ziploc bag, you can use 2 bags and separate the marinade into 2. But I poured it all into a Ziploc bag and let that marinate for an hour. And every, you know, 10 minutes or when I was thinking about it, I would turn the bag over so that the marinade would cover all of the mushrooms. And then, while that's marinating, I sauteed 1 onion. And you also need 1 pound of spinach, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 teaspoon of minced garlic, 1 bunch of asparagus, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, and 1/2 cup of coconut milk. Then you need 1/2 a red pepper and 1/2 a yellow pepper that you're going to use also to slice and put on top of the mushrooms. So while the mushrooms are marinating, I sauteed the onions in a heavy saute pan until they were translucent. I added the garlic and the spinach to that, and I continued cooking that until the spinach is soft. And you had to put the spinach in rounds. It all doesn't fit in the pan at once. But within a minute, the spinach wilts down and makes room for more spinach. And you just keep adding the spinach until the whole pound of spinach is used up. Then I removed that from the pan and put it into my food processor, and I pureed the spinach along with the coconut milk, the salt, and the nutmeg. And then I tossed the asparagus with some olive oil and salt. And I actually added tarragon yesterday, which adds a nice flavor as well. So sprinkle a little tarragon on the asparagus and roast that in a 350-degree oven for about 5 minutes, just until the asparagus gets soft. Then I removed the mushrooms from the marinade, and I grilled them 5 minutes on each side. And since I was doing it indoors, you have to be careful to adjust the heat under the griddle. I put the griddle across the 2 burners, the front burner and the back burner, and wait till the griddle gets hot before you actually put the mushrooms on it. I sprayed it with some olive oil spray and put the mushrooms on. I put them capside down first, all right, so that the cap part of the mushroom was touching the griddle, because that's the where you're going to get the grill lines. And then I cooked those for about 5 minutes. Once they were soft, and some of the mushrooms were fatter than others, so I left some on for a little longer. And you're going to turn them over, so you're grilling on the other side as well. And once the mushrooms are cooked, you can remove them from the griddle, stuff them with the pureed spinach, then lay across the top 3 asparagus spears, and then in the other direction, yellow pepper, red pepper, and a yellow pepper. and just decorate it. And then you serve them. And on my website, you can see the picture of how beautiful they look. And it's just a real showstopper. It's beautiful presentation. It's delicious. And it's a real meal in itself. Although, of course, I served it with the rice and the salad, which really completed it. So please enjoy. Feel free to experiment with that. I mean, cream spinach is only one stuffing. You can stuff those portobello mushrooms with whatever you like. You can add some tofu to it or some beans for some extra protein. But as we know, vegetables have protein too. So enjoy. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Michael Kilpatrick. As I said before, he's a farmer, a presenter, he's a host, an inventor, and an online entrepreneur. His passion is to help entrepreneurs apply business principles and practical proven solutions to help grow their businesses and simplify their lives. Michael has managed large certified organic farms and businesses, consulted for industry experts, and spoken at dozens of industry conferences. And I'm thrilled to introduce him and his online business growing farmers to all of you. Michael, are you with me?
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So I'm so impressed with everything that you're doing. I thought maybe you could start by just telling my listeners a little bit about your farming background. What's your experience?
Yeah, so I've actually been interested in growing things since I was like 6 years old. My mom has a picture of me with like a dozen slugs all over my hands. That was before I realized that slugs were bad for the garden, just because I enjoyed growing and getting out. And so my first thing we grew was a tomato plant against the side of our apartment back in St. Louis, but that quickly grew. And then in 2005, 2004, my brother and I started a farm together in upstate New York. And that grew rapidly. Eventually, we were managing around 500 acres. We had a team of 20, and we were selling vegetables throughout the entire Capital District in upstate New York.
I'm going to stop you for a minute. How do you go from growing a tomato plant on the side of your St. Louis apartment to managing 500 acres in upstate New York? What happened to
you
from there?
No one told me I couldn't do it, so I just kept growing. but we grew in St. Louis. Then my dad started a bigger garden in Massachusetts, which we really enjoyed.
St. Louis to Massachusetts?
My grandparents lived in Connecticut, so we moved up to Massachusetts to be nearer to them. And when I was about like 7. Then we went to New York. End of 1999, my dad wanted to get out of suburbia when the Y2K thing hit. He read a book, and we wanted to move to the country, and it was great because we already did want to move to the country. So it's just the impetus to make us do that. But I started with growing ducklings. We got some ducklings in the mail, and oh my gosh, I was thrilled. But then we rapidly realized that animals, which are much more a low margin enterprise than the vegetables are. The vegetables are just, it's a great business. They don't run away on you. The foxes don't eat them. And so we started growing the vegetables in our front yard and started adding greenhouses. And eventually the next fall, we just couldn't get all the vegetables out of the ground before it froze. So we started hiring people. And then after that, it just grew.
Okay, when was that, when you were managing the 500 acres in upstate New York?
Yeah, so we started, the farm rapidly grew. 2010 was kind of where we started to manage a lot more land. In 2012, I actually ended up interning at Polyface, Joel Salatin's farm down in Virginia, which is a multi-species pasture-based farm. And that's where I met my wife. And so we got married the next year. And then we managed the farm for a little bit longer until we had a child, Charlotte. And then after that, we made it a difficult decision to move to Ohio to be near her family. So that was around 2015. And that's when we leased out the farm to two of our employees. And so I stopped full-time farming.
And that farm was in near Polyface?
So Polyface is in Virginia. So that's where I basically took the summer off from my farm. I left my farm for 4 months and interned at another farm because we're huge proponents of of learning, of education, of learning from the best. And so I made that. It was definitely a financial decision for us, for me to take that 4 months off. The business, you know, survived it. It wasn't super easy, but the crew was incredible. They pulled through. But yeah, that's how much we value education. And the doors that is open just through around the world and meeting people in the regeneratively minded space has been incredible. So it was well worth that. But, you know, I think the thing is the why we do what we do now is a direct came directly from running that farm in New York, because we were incredibly profitable. I mean, I took a salary from the farm that paid for my housing. We had a budget every year to grow the farm and invest in new tools and equipment and infrastructure. But when we passed that farm to the two employees, within 12 months, they went bankrupt. And this farm had, you know, wonderful equipment. It had beautiful land. I mean, we were managing 500 acres, which transferred mostly right to those new farmers. Most of my team ended up working for the new folks, as well as there was a hole left in the local marketplace that those farmers could directly fill. But what was lacking was the management and the business side. And so when I saw that fail within 12 months, it was incredible to see what happened. It really shook me to my core, because obviously I'd spent 10 years building this, and this was kind of like my baby, and then to watch it just go belly up. But it also made me start looking at the full farming industry and just how unprofitable most farms are and how many fail. It's a known fact that only 5% of farms last over 5 years. And so we have a massive problem in our farming industry of not running them as businesses and not seeing the bigger picture and making sure that they are profitable so they can be truly sustainable.
Mm-hmm. And did you have experience in business administration or in business, or was it just all hands-on learning that you and your brother did?
That's a great question. So a couple years in, I actually started taking some classes at the local community college, and I ended up taking two. And then I realized that I was actually getting better experience in the farm than taking the classes. And so, you know, I aced both of those classes, and then I just started reading the books. So they would obviously give us, like, you should read these books for this class. And I just started listening to them on audiobook as I was driving the tractor. You know, sometimes 6-8 hours a day of being able to immerse myself in business training. But we also had a really good business manager. You know, it was a mom in the local community, a single mom who needed a job that was super flexible because she was taking care of her two young children at the time. And we said, hey, you know, as long as the books get done, we don't care when you do it. So she would show up at 8 o'clock at night, work till 10 o'clock at night after her kids were down in our office, or take the books home. And she was kind of a little bit of a mentor to me in the business side of things. Like, you know, Michael, this is how payroll works. And, you know, this is how you take profits, and this is how you reinvest back into the business. So between that combination of her running the business side, me listening to the books, and then me also having great mentors. So one of the things I've always been passionate about is learning and seeking out the best people to learn from. So even now, we're looking at getting a new operation started, and we're doing a lot of research and details. And I will be spending some one-on-one days with people that I respect in the industry to pick their brains. So we had incredible mentors around us in where we were in New York, upstate New York. You know, Paul and Sandy Arnold have been farming for 30 years up there. They were incredible mentors. The first place I got my start was in Pillamer Farm in Vermont. They're no longer in business, but he was an incredible grower, and he taught us so much about that. And then just the general farming community is just being able to ask different farmers how they farm certain things and why they did what they did.
And I assume your farm was organic, yes?
Yeah, so we started off as certified naturally grown, and we did that for about 9 years. And then near the end, people were talking about how difficult it was to become certified organic. And I was like, well, I'll just do it. I'll see how tough it is. And so, yeah, it took probably about, you know, 4 to 5 solid days of pulling together all the necessary records. But, you know, if you have good records, it's a heck of a lot easier to put that presentation together for the inspector that comes out to your farm and walks your farm with you. So a lot of it was just kind of reformatting everything that we had for records anyway to make sure that they could track, you know, what we were doing, making sure that we were following the rules.
Were you certified by NOFA New York?
We were actually certified through a company called EcoCert, and I think they're out of the Midwest. And the reason mainly we went with them is we keep digital records for everything on our farm, and we wanted to be able to a certifier that would work with digital records. So at the time, NOFA New York wasn't doing that. So the digital records is our inspector can see, you know, immediately when we've applied something or when we've done, you know, an eco spray or when we've changed the plan instead of having to send a brand new paper application or something into NOFA New York. And obviously it's been a number of years since I've worked, so NOFA could have changed that. But that's why at that time we went with that company.
I see. Uh-huh. Yeah, because as you know, I'm on the board of NOFA New York.
Yeah.
And I'm very passionate about the great work they do. And, you know, I did not realize this, but I have now become aware that all certifiers are not equal either.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot of certifiers that let a lot of things slide. And NOFA, you know, if something's certified by NOFA New York, it's really truly organic.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, and NOFA does great work. We actually did a couple of field days with them over the years. I'm trying to remember the year that they actually came out and did a great big field day. I think it was maybe 2014. But yeah, definitely spoke at their conference a number of times, attended a bunch more fabulous work that they're doing.
Yeah. So I was so impressed that, you know, I was looking at your farm summits, and, you know, for my listeners, I think it's really, they'd really love to know about these farm summits and the work that you're doing online, making so much of the knowledge base that you share accessible for everybody. So can we talk a little bit about the farm summits that you do online?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea came to me when someone sent me an email and said, Michael, I love what you're doing, but I love what all these other farms are doing. I wish there was a way to learn from all of you at once. And so, you know, up until that point, we had probably done 40 interviews for our podcast. And I was like, you know what? I bet I could get a lot of these people that have presented on our podcast to come back and share like a slide presentation and more like a training. So like the podcast is more of like a, how's your farm doing? You know, what are you doing on your farm? But the summits are more like, here's a deep dive and exactly how we're tracking our numbers for our, you know, lettuce operation, or here's how we're marketing this. And it goes into a lot more detail. It's actionable takeaway information to go then implement in your business. And so it just started growing. And by the time we ran the summit, we had over 30 speakers, everything from, you know, farm business to marketing. We had Charlotte Smith come on and share marketing, to elderberries, to William Padilla Brown shared about mushrooms. So we just had a fabulous time. And if you go to www.farmsummits.com, you can see the one we did last year, and I believe you can still sign up. And then you can also see some of our future summits, which we will be running here shortly.
Uh-huh. So the summits, do they have to be attended live, like when they're happening, or it's all recorded so people can like take advantage of last year's Farm Summit now? Is that possible?
Yeah, so how we have it is we have a live version, and that's so much fun because we'll get speakers that actually come on and do Q&A. We run giveaways. We have incredible sponsors which provide some great prizes and all of that. So that's an experience all in of itself. But we also do have an evergreen aspect where you can actually go and sign up right now, and then you'll get the 3 days sent to you each day for you, so you have the access to that over the time. So it's a fabulous, anyone can go right now and sign up and enjoy that.
Uh-huh. That's great. And especially right now in this time of COVID and everybody working from home, it's really so timely to have that happening now. When is your next Farm Summit coming on?
Yeah, we don't have exact dates, but the goal is that be the first weekend in December again. So that was when we ran the last one, and I think it's a really good time for our audience. And, you know, again, there's a lot to get ready for it, so it takes us a while to pull it all together. So, yeah, we're super excited. We've got a great topic, and we've already started to line up and lock in the key presenters. So we're super excited for this year's summit.
Yeah. Well, I went to the website from last year, and it was very impressive, all the speakers that you had. And, of course, I'm a big fan of Joel Salatin as well.
Uh-huh.
He spoke at our Long Island, our first Long Island food conference that we had. Actually, back then it was actually called Farm Summit.
Okay.
And he was just amazing. And when I went onto your website and looked at your growing farmers, it seems like, as you had said, your time there connected you with so many others, because it seems like your team has all come from Polyface Farm. So at
yes.
some in their history. Is that accurate?
So, yeah, our consulting team. So, yeah, we have a couple different divisions of our business. The consulting side is one of them. And, yeah, as a lot of us came from Polyface, met there. Actually, the business partner, Ben, who actually helped me build this current business, you know, I was actually speaking to him last Saturday. They now run a very successful herd share dairy down in Virginia. He helped me start the company. And then obviously once they got funded for their farm, they moved into that full time. And I'm just blown away by what they've done down there.
Uh-huh. So, let's talk about your business growing farmers. You know, as part of your business growing farmers, you also have a consulting aspect, right? Where you consult. Can you explain to my listeners how that works?
Yeah, so that's actually a much smaller part of our business now, because what we learned rapidly in the beginning is consulting is one-on-one. Teaching like an online class or the summit is one-to-many. So we really are trying to reach as many people as possible. And now, you know, every single week we reach more than 50,000 farmers around the world through our, you know, email communications, and then hundreds of thousands on our social media. But so that's the one side. But the thing about a consultancy is that's where we really deep dive into what people's challenges are. So yes, we can teach a class, but I mean, as you know, every single farm is different. There are not two, you know, very exact farm. Every farm has a little bit of a different, you know, the weather's different, or the market's different, or the farmer's different, or what their goal, their holistic context is different. So we really, that's where the consultation really works, is where we identify the exact parameters of that person's farm, and then we work inside that context to build the best plan for them. So that's an exciting part of our business, even though we don't do it as much. One of the huge advantages I have is I have now traveled around the world and visited hundreds of farms and seen all different sorts of systems and setups. And so that gives me a really good context to be able to say, well, actually, you know, for this part of your business, you might want to model it on what this farm has done, or maybe we'll tweak that and add that here. So it is a super fun part of the business.
Uh-huh. And so do you still have a farm now in Ohio, or are you mostly now doing this, your business?
So the business is very full time, but we do still farm. So we've got a third of an acre. We live in town, and we farm the backyard and the side yard, and we have a hoop house and all sorts of things going on there. We feed ourselves and many of our neighbors. And then we rent a couple of acres outside of town where we do much more broad acreage crops. So last year we grew a bunch of pumpkins and squash, and we did a large sunflower field for the community. This year we're actually ramping up the squash production. We'll be adding some root production, so we'll be adding some root production for wholesale as well as doing some of the sunflowers. So we actually have some big projects coming up, which we're really right now in the weeds about. But hopefully we can, you know, kind of share a little bit more about those as we kind of get more clarity on them.
Oh, great. Great. Michael, we're going to take a couple minute break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about some of the tutorials and courses that you actually have on your website that are just so great. I actually watched, you know, the one about washing greens, and it was just so great. So everyone, don't go anywhere. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Michael Kilpatrick about his business Growing Farmers, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
New Yorkers are generous, and they are grateful and gracious, and when you need help, we will be there for you.
The soldiers in this fight are our health care professionals. It's the doctors, it's the nurses, it's the people who are working in the hospitals, it's the aides. They are the soldiers who are fighting this battle for us. You know the expression, save our troops, quote unquote. In this battle, the troops are healthcare professionals.
Thank you, the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial-free and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media. So Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Michael Kilpatrick. He is the co-founder of Growing Farmers and also of Farm Summits Online. So, Michael, right before the break, I wanted to share with my listeners about some of your courses that you have online, some of your tutorials. I shared that I had watched one about washing greens. So maybe you could talk a bit about what you offer online.
Yeah, so our goal has been to look out at our farming community, and again, we have so many farmers in our farming community from around the world, and see what the biggest challenges that they are facing every single day, and you know how we can help them solve that. So, you know, one of the things that we saw was that farmers were having problems with washing and then drying salad mix. You know, salad mix is one of those massive crops that so many of our farmers work with. It's profitable for farmers. It's really economical to buy from local farmers at the store, and so it's one of the number one products for many of the farmers we work with, and so. There's a couple things that we had done on our farm to make it more efficient. And so we just developed a mini course around that. And we've literally had thousands of people go through that now. It shows them step by step exactly what to do. Now, you know, there's a lot of people out there that can figure it out on their own. They're super smart. They just look at it and figure it out. But there's others that just really want to be that step by step instruction that's just going to save them time. And in these courses, we list the exact things they need. You know, you need 6 feet of this size pipe. You need this connector. You need this clamp. Here's exactly where you get it. So they can literally sit there, order all the parts. The parts come in. They build it in a couple hours. So it's all about saving farmers time. So those are the tutorials, and we have them all around, you know, the washing. We have them on indoor seed starting. So many farms struggle with having a good seed starting system. So we built a whole one inside. Also germination, crop germination. We have another one around that. We just put out a course on seeders. So, you know, small hand seeders are something many farmers have, but they're very frustrating for farmers. And so we put together a course that reviews all the small seeders, walks them through best ways to use them and how to calibrate them for best results so they can save time and save seed. And then we move into more of, I would say, like the farm business side of this. So we have ones on funding your farm. We're actually just about to launch one on your simple business plan and funding options. So I'm actually, before I jumped on this call, was literally writing the offer page for that to show people what they're going to learn in that 4-week class. We have a number of different trainings. We also have some macro class. So these are the micro classes, what we kind of discussed. The macro classes is something that takes a specific subject and deep dives. So we've actually worked with some of the experts in our industry to put some of these classes together. One we did with Ray Tyler is on lettuce production. So basically, again, lettuce production is a huge thing for folks, and growing it year-round can be really challenging, especially in the hot, humid summers of the South or like the cold winters of the North. And so we worked with Ray, who consistently grows grows lettuce 52 weeks out of the year in the hot, humid Tennessee, and he has a specific system he follows, and so we helped him build a course around that. And so now we've had hundreds of folks go through that course and are now successfully growing lettuce everywhere from, you know, the Bahamas all the way to northern Canada and even Alaska. So that's kind of the different things that we offer and how we kind of work with farmers in those different tutorials and courses.
Mm-hmm. And you work, all the farmers that you're working with are working in regenerative and sustainable methodologies, correct?
Yeah. So one of the things we were really specific on when we started is, yes, we have a very regeneratively-based farming system, and that's what we recommend. But we don't want to alienate, because what we realize is a lot of people come into farming, or a lot of people who are in farming and are interested in changing their businesses, immediately get repulsed when people come and are just very, like, dogmatic about, we got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. And so we were very careful to, we try to be, not recommend, but be inclusive. So like the whole thing with hydroponics is, I personally don't think hydroponics is a good growing system. You know, soil to me is awesome. Aquaponics is a good start. But we're not going, if someone has questions about hydroponics, we're going to say, you know what, these are the folks that have those solutions. You know, we recognize and we love soil farming for these reasons. And what we find is a lot of people find us, they come in with maybe a system that's not quite as regenerative as we'd like. And after they go through some of our programs and see how we're doing things, they switch over because they find it's actually easier. So that's how we've kind of built our company, and that's our kind of stand on it. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we'll never use Roundup on our farm. You know, we're very careful about, you know, how we are, you know, set things up. But again, we just want to extend that bridge to those who are exploring, so they have a path to focusing their farms on regenerative farming.
You know, it's very interesting, because I agree with you 100% that, you know, you're going to attract more people with honey than with vinegar. And you just have to, you want to be inclusive. You know, I am a natural chef, and I mostly cook vegetarian, you know, on occasion. You know, I've had private clients where I'll cook meat for them or fish for them, but mostly vegetarian. I have mostly transitioned to plant-based now, or vegan. But at the same time, I don't want to alienate anyone. And so, you know, in my cooking, I really am inclusive, and I don't want to turn anybody off. And I want to get people excited about the possibilities of eating plant-based, but that it's not an all-or-nothing thing, that you can experiment with it. And what's so important is people to know that, you know, you're not only eating salads. You know, if there's other things out there people don't even know are options, whether it's tofu, tempeh, seitan, beans, they don't know how to do anything with to make meal feel more substantial. So I think, you know, the path of inclusivity is so important in really bridging that gap and winning people over, because you win them over,
Absolutely. The chemicals
are just bad for everybody on every level. You know, from the planet to, you know, the soil to people's health. So,
yeah. And I think we're starting to see, too, and this is the really cool thing, is that regenerative agriculture, time and time again, is showing the better way forward. You know, first it was DDT getting banned. Then it was Rotenone. Now it's, you know, they're saying, oh, dicamba is actually losing its permits. And so Roundup has now been shown to cause cancer. So now we're seeing, you know, what we've been saying for so long is actually finally being admitted by the industry. You know, yes, we've been talking about it and trying to sound the alarm, but now we're getting backed up by, you know, by the official science, science channel. So that's something that I think is so awesome, that we're starting to see such a big shift towards that regenerative aspect. You know, General Mills is now like 100% on board with regenerative farming, and has an, you know, entire brand now around that, and just gave $1 million to a soil health organization to train farmers on this. So I am just so excited about the direction our country is going, and other countries as well. We're seeing a lot of good things going on there, but it just makes me excited to be able to train farmers in this time.
Yeah, although you also heard my opening where, you know, we have the EPA, you know, looking the other way and allowing, you know, decamping.
Yeah.
And, you know, just not enforcing the regulations that, you know, that are law. I mean, it's just blatant, you know, disregard for the rules. So we have a problem in the country right now, but hopefully that will get remedied in November. So let's talk about local food and the local food movement. You know, I hear, you know, from so many people, you know, especially when we're talking about racism and food costs, you know, that local or healthy food costs so much more. Should local food cost more? What's the story there?
Yeah.
As far as you see it.
Yeah, it's a complex issue. And let's start by talking about conventional food. So let's start by talking about what the status quo is right now. So the status quo is right now is thousands of acres of and tens of thousands of acres in California, New Mexico is being used to grow much of this food. That land is incredibly expensive. The farmers make money 1 year out of five. And the main reason they only keep farming is because they have such a high debt load, they can't stop farming without, you know, going bankrupt and broke. It's even in the I would like to say industrial organic systems out there, it's really bad. And the profitability for these farmers is really low. And so that what it has done, and because everything now goes through a food chain with between four to five different people before it gets to your plate, the farmers are out there are losing money, and everyone along the way has decided their business model has to make money. And so what happens is that food is incredibly cheap, especially because we still have low fuel prices, low oil prices. And so what ends up on your plate is usually a week old. It's going to go bad the next day. It's got less nutrients in it, and it's cheap. And so, you know, quality always gets more money. And so if you have a farmer that's producing great quality lettuce from the local farm, that is going to be more expensive because it's a better product. And we tell farmers they should charge more than what you find in the grocery store because it's a better product. Now, absolutely, there's a range of prices they can charge. And I do see some places where I'm like, this is a ripoff. I mean, like you can buy arugula and salad mix in New York City at Union Square for $48 a pound. My friend Ray Tyler sells his lettuce, I think, between $6 and $8 a pound, maybe $10 a pound. So obviously there's some great local options. Another thing, and the reason why we exist as a company, is we just see massive amounts of wasted effort in inefficiency and ineffectiveness in the farming systems. And so once a lot of these farmers see those and figure out how to eliminate those, their production costs go down. And they're able to produce things for cheaper while making a profit on their farms. And so, you know, that's a lot of the stuff we teach, and that's what a lot of the trainings we do is how to build those efficiencies into their farm. Because, you know, yes, anyone can grow a lettuce, but can you grow, cut, pack, and sell a bag of lettuce? There's so many steps involved for that. Let's talk a little bit back, though, about the challenges with local farming, too, is every local farm has a different weather system. I mean, if you're in a little valley, you're going to have different than the person that's up in the hill. And so dealing with weather adds this whole nother level of aspects of that local food, which makes it more difficult, more expensive for the local farmer to grow. But what I want to bring back to, too, is that, you know, there was a study done a couple of years ago about local food and food coming from CSAs or farmers market, and then like comparing it directly to what's in the store. And what they found is that I think this was done by Growing for Market a number of years back, the magazine. And what they found is actually local food was, I think, on average, 10 to 30% cheaper. Because, you know, when you bought a head of lettuce, it lasted longer in your fridge. It was actually bigger and more full. And there was just, and I'm not even talking about the nutrition value of that. So, you know, yeah. And so, again, as I said, there are some places you go to a farmer's market and think, oh, my gosh, those carrots are really expensive. But another thing is a lot of this is supply and demand. So someone's selling, you know, 3 to 4 inches long baby carrots, you know, premium baby carrots, maybe grown in June, 1st of July, and people just love those. And so, yeah, that bunch of carrots is going to be $4. And that bunch of carrots, when you cut the carrots off, that is going to be $10 a pound. That same farmer will probably sell bulk carrots, $1.50 a pound or something like that in the fall when there's less of demand for that baby carrot. So, you know, specialty crops, because they're a lot more expensive to grow, should demand the aspect there. But there is a lot of areas in the local food system that are cheaper and more economical for the public in many aspects. And, you know, if you are feeding a large family or you don't have a huge budget, farmers are the most giving people I've ever met. They are incredible. And so I would recommend you go to your local farmer, talk to them about that, and say, hey, you know, how can we work out something where I can still get this your great amazing produce? Can I, you know, come to a work share on the farm? Can I, you know, at the end of farmers markets, come and buy whatever you have left over? You know, can I, you know, buy your seconds? So on our farm, we had a stream every single week of about 300 to 500 pounds of seconds because, you know, some of the crops just aren't perfect and our farmers markets didn't necessarily want those. And so most of it went to the Community Action, which was a community food bank, and they would come out to the farm, pick it up, take it to people of need in the local area. But we also had chefs and even local families that would say, hey, I need 10 pounds or 20 pounds at a time. And, you know, we would sell that for 50 cents or a dollar a pound. So there's all sorts of aspects. And I just encourage folks to really start to look at their local food system, because I'm sure there's an option.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that so much, because I have also found that, you know, not only farmers that are growing intentionally to help food pantries, but they appreciate people going out into the field and harvesting or, you know, picking the stuff that's fallen off, because they don't have the money and the labor to do that. And so they're really happy to have people come and take from the field, you know, so that's a really wonderful option that I agree with very much. So what are some of the biggest challenges you think facing farmers right now in besides the weather?
Yeah, besides weather, that's always a big one. You know, one, I still think, unfortunately, there's a great dearth in good quality education for farmers. And along with that is a massive dearth in how farmers can get started. Because, you know, writing a business plan, the old style of 40-page business plan is incredibly overwhelming. And so farmers are like, where do I even get started, you know? So having those numbers for farmers is such a key. And there's some great organizations out there that are working on that. The Intervale up in Vermont has some great resources. My friends over at Kitchen Table Consultants, and we're actually doing a webinar with them tonight for our folks. We have 1,000 people signed up to attend about crop costing. So there's a massive need out there for this, the financial information around farms. And because once farms look at their numbers, frequently they're like, oh, this is losing me money. I need to stop this enterprise and let someone else who's more qualified run it or has a better setup for that. And so that's one of the big things, is lack of education and lack of understanding the business side, the finances of it. Another aspect is lack of land access. So, you know, we have a huge disparity between the land owned in the U.S. and the people who want to farm it. And the problem is we have a broken ag system, is we have one that rewards massive commodity farming, which is destroying the earth at an unprecedented rate. And then we have the small farm, which wants to get started. You know, first, if they find land, if they have conventional land around there, they can get spray drift. I've worked with multiple farms in the last couple of years that have gotten their land spray drifted. And even if they can sue, the chemical companies have the deep pockets and can usually put you, they'll run you out of money before you actually win. So you can totally, you know, have it shown, have it proven that you have been spray drifted and your farm has been ruined, but they will drag their feet and put all these motions in place. And I know multiple farmers that that's happened to, and it's incredibly heartbreaking because they're incredibly great people and they've just been steamrolled. So I think those are the big ones, you know, kind of like the weather, lack of information and business support, and that's why we exist, the farm startup and funding, access to land, and then, you know, chemical contamination.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the spray drift is such a big problem, and so you have to be so careful when you find that land, you know, how close are you to another farm, and is that farm conventional or you know, organic or sustainable at least. Big challenges. So you want to share the webinar that you are running tonight and what's going on with, you know, anything else that my listeners can plug in with?
Yeah, let me pull up that link really quick here. If you go to growingfarmers.com and then you go to / crop costing webinar. So yeah, www.growingfarmers.com, actually it's / crop costing webinar. You'll be taken right to that page and be able to sign up for tonight's, I think it's at 7 o'clock Eastern time. And actually it was delayed from last week because Elaine, who's presenting, she lost power. Another thing I'll bring up too is rural internet. Is farmers struggle so much with rural internet and being able to actually access stuff online just because of that. So she lost her power in her internet, so she couldn't present the webinar. But yeah, we're looking forward. Great forecast for tonight. She should be all good to go.
Great. Well, Michael, it's been so great talking with you. You have such a wealth of knowledge. You know, I was reading also some of the tutorials by some of the farmers that have taken your courses and how helpful it's been. And so I just want to thank you for the work you're doing and for the help you are offering to farmers. My last question is just for those listening, how expensive are the courses? Like, are they affordable for farmers?
We have stuff that starts at, let's say, like just $27, all the way up to some of our larger stuff is several hundred dollars. But, you know, even like some of our more expensive stuff, they are set up and we've built them so that within 3 to 4 weeks, you can make your money back by implementing. So, you know, it's not about how much you spend. It's about what the return on that investment is. And that's what we work with farmers on. But yeah, I mean, we try to start out folks with, you know, some of these smaller things that they can get started with and really start to get some traction. And then as they have more time and effort and money, start to upgrade to some of the larger purchases and grow their farm.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this week. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and Michael Kilpatrick has been my guest. See you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week, and enjoy. Bye for now.